I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today, our guests have advice on how you can make your city greener, healthier, and smarter. Lawrence Katz is the co-author of the book, The Race Between Education and Technology. In it, he describes how the 20th century American education system made this nation the richest in the world, but why the third great education transformation, mass universal access to college, is still ahead of us. We'll also speak with Mitchell Joachim. Mitchell is an architect and thinker who wants to redesign cities from the ground up. He'll tell us about stackable cars, living walls, and houses that grow themselves. Plus, we'll hear from our regular contributors, Nate Berg, and City View's commentator, Walker Smith. Stick around for Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Lawrence Katz is an economist at Harvard University. He's written often about issues of labor economics and social problems, and his latest book, co-authored with Claudia Golden, is The Race Between Education and Technology. In it, he describes the history of social inequality in America as it relates to educational and technological advances. He joined us from his office on the Harvard campus to talk about the link between educational achievement and economic success. There is a huge wage premium today for completion of a college degree. Explain why.
The reason for a very large wage premium for completing a college degree is because the demand for college-level skills, more abstract skills, has grown dramatically as technology has evolved, particularly in recent decades, and the growth of the number of people with those skills has not kept pace. So back in 1980 or so, someone who earned a college degree earned about 30% more than someone who just had a high school degree. Today, they earn sort of 80% or almost double what someone had a high school degree with. And the big changes are that as sectors, you know, like until recently, finance as well as scientific and other areas and demand for people with sort of a broad range of, you know, abstracts and problem-solving skills has grown, we haven't kept up the supply of those types of people as access to education hasn't grown with them. Whereas in the past, if you looked from, say, 1900 to 1980, we did a much better job of giving new cohorts the tools to have education to fit in with the new technologies and the new jobs of what then were the future. And so when technology races forward and education doesn't keep pace, there becomes a growing premium to higher education. And that's what's happened over recent decades.
So technology has increased the need for people with abstract skills has increased, and college attainment has not kept pace.
Right. College attainment has increased in the U.S., but not as fast it would need to keep up with it, and it's slowed down. A way of thinking of this is if you look over the last century, someone born 50 years ago had, you know, more than 2 years more schooling than their parents. Someone born 25 years ago today who'd recently have completed college or high school only has about half a year more of schooling than their parents. So we're increasing education, but not at the pace we did in the past and not at the pace needed to keep up with changes in the economy and demands for more educated workers.
We no longer even lead the world in the education of young adults. Which nations are ahead of us?
Well, if you look at sort of years of schooling among rich countries, there are about, you know, 10 or 11 nations that lead the U.S., ranging from the Scandinavian nations to the Netherlands, even places like Ireland, the U.K. So what we are is we're one of the worst among rich countries in getting people to finish high school. Only about 75% to 80% of American youth now finish high school in normal time, you know, not counting GEDs. And most other countries are up about 90%. We still lead the world in getting people to start college, but we're not that great at getting people to actually through college. And so a number of countries, you know, have, say, 40% of their young people getting four-year college degrees, and we're sort of in the low 30s these days. So the U.S. has the most educated 50-year-olds in the world, but we're in the middle of the pack among, you know, Europe and East Asia and other wealthy countries in terms of 25-year-olds.
Well, that's a terrible trend. Why are we having so few
youth finish high school?
Well, that's, you know, a very difficult question. We did a remarkable job of being the first country in the world to sort of provide mass access to public high schools with free tuition and locally pretty much spread out through the nation in the first half of the century, and we sprinted ahead. But since about 1970, we've shown almost no growth in the fraction of youth who complete high school. Some of that has to do with the increasing disadvantages of, you know, a lot of families and things that are happening before kids are entering the school system. Some of that really is that our wonderful, local-funded, highly competitive school systems of the earlier era were very good at getting us to three-quarters of people finishing high school, but don't seem to be the right way to create, going all the way to sort of 90%. We have pockets of areas where schools have real resource problems, where kids come disproportionately from families without two parents around. And given our decentralized system, often they are crowded in inner city schools and in many rural areas with fewer resources. And we have had not so great an ability for these districts to improve. We've tried to impose standards without resources, and we've not done such a great job of recruiting teachers in the recent period.
Well, don't we spend, though, today a lot more money on education than we spent, say, pre-1970, when you say we were doing a very good job of increasing high school attainment?
Yes, it is true that we spend more money than we did in the past. You know, and there's sort of two schools of thought on why. One school of thought, which I think is that there just aren't enough resources in the schools, total amounts of money being spent. The other is that we don't seem to use the resources in schools very effectively. So in the first half of the century, we had a very competitive system, many, many small districts, and they competed to, you know, do a good job to have people move to those areas. In recent decades, we've sort of moved to a hybrid. We neither have the sort of strong federal national standards that everyone needs to meet that many European systems do, nor do we have the old American system of every sort of district, you know, is very decentralized. Their funding, how much funding they get depends on how well they do. We have this hodgepodge of perverse incentives where we tend to equalize things, but we don't do it very well. Combinations of big city school districts where it's difficult to, you know, hire the types of teachers you want. And it really is a difficult system to understand. But a big part of the problem really is that we seem to neither be willing to go all the way to have, you know, strong central standardization accountability, nor go all the way to have real competition and choice. And so we're left with a hybrid system that doesn't seem to work as well as it could.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Lawrence Katz about his latest book, co-authored with Claudia Golden, about academic achievement and economic prosperity. Let's go back to what we've done right in education. You point out in your book that America has experienced two great educational transformations and that we could be on the verge of a third. We've not yet been able to get over the edge or over the goal line on that third one. Describe those first two transformations and their impact on the nation.
The first transformation is what's known as the Common School Movement, and it happened in the 19th century. And this was the fact that through much of the United States, particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest, basically every local community created a wonderfully operating common school that provided access through at least 8 years of schooling, universally available at free tuition. And this was really pioneered by people like Horace Mann in Massachusetts and spread particularly as New Englanders moved around the nation. And it really did put us at the forefront. And if we think about Yankee tinkerers and sort of the wonderful innovation of the American economy as it moved forward, setting up the American system of mass production, young individuals such as a Thomas Edison or an Andrew Carnegie, they had this wonderful common school education that gave them the basics. And we were the first to create mass access, really done at the local level. It was done in a gender-neutral way. Girls were just as likely to get access as boys, unlike many other countries, and done really in a fine American egalitarian manner. Similarly, In the late 19th century, one started to notice there were certain jobs, you know, like working as a clerical worker, working as a bookkeeper, working as a skilled engineer in production that required more schooling than common school. And you started getting small private academies that gave people further skills, little business school academies. And noticing this, many areas, small towns and cities, started building and providing access to what we now consider the modern high school. And in the high school movement, we moved far ahead of the rest of the world in the late 19th, early 20th century in creating universal access to secondary schooling and having a general set of skills that wasn't just learning to be an apprenticeship in one position that your father did, learning a broad set of skills that were valuable in a changing economy, both for production and clerical jobs. And we did that at the local level, a grassroots movement, and it responded. The very high returns to getting further schooling that you saw in the 19th century, to getting a job like a clerical worker, created incentives for local areas to provide access to schooling. And because many of these areas, you know, think of small towns in Iowa or Nebraska, were close-knit communities, there was a sense that even though the older groups in the community would be paying for these schools, that it was kids or kids of friends of theirs that were benefiting. And somehow that pattern is broken down as we're in a more anonymous area where the older individuals in communities seem to be less connected to the younger individuals. We have people moving out into retirement areas where they don't connect with the youth in their area. So there's less funding there. And at the college level, we started in that place, particularly many states with land-grant colleges, the GI Bill. But we've never done for college what we did with high school, which is to create essentially universal access, either without tuition or with a set of loans that anyone can get. We have a very complicated and convoluted financial aid system and rapidly growing tuition payments. So even for those who finish high school in good standing, the ability to do a full college degree is not expanded like we expanded access to high school and common schooling before. And today, you know, the sets of skills one learns in college are as important as those that one learned in high school 75 years ago. The third transformation is still quite incomplete. We led the world in the high school and common school transformation. In the college transformation, we're falling behind.
Now, let's go back to that second transformation, the high school movement. You write in your book that high school graduation rates are in fact declining. And so what do you attribute that to?
The movement, as we set up, created universal access where everyone can go to high school at their public high school for free. And it got us by the mid-century outside of the segregated South to high school graduation rates, you know, in the 70%. And we have sort of stalled out there. And as I noted, the way the U.S. did the high school movement is this very decentralized way. So that's very good at taking off and starting and getting to a level of about 70%, but it leaves pockets of inner city schools of certain rural areas that don't have the resources to move beyond. So that's one possibility. The other possibility are substantial changes in family structure that have taken place over time and more kids sort of entering school in more unstable environments. But the truth is, we don't have a perfectly good single explanation for this. You know, it is a bit of a puzzle. Some of it may have to do with the fact that the U.S. has always been a system that's been very forgiving and given people second chances. There are many routes. And one of the things we innovated on in recent years is allowing people to drop out of high school and have the notion that they could go forward and get a GED and then look just like a high school graduate. And in fact, the GED is a wonderful device for people who, for, you know, some reasons, had problems in high school and can come back and get a credential and move on to further education. To many kids, it's a bit of an illusion. The notion that you don't have to work hard now because you can always go back and get this other degree, it's not equivalent to a high school degree. Many kids think they're going to go back and get a GED and, in fact, never do so. And so I think the second chance system has many benefits, but sometimes being too lenient on it may lead kids, particularly ones who aren't having a lot of fun in school, which lots of us had, to think that there's another route that's easier.
Let's talk about the third transformation, the mass access, universal access, and free or easy access to loans for mass participation in college. Some college administrators would say, we're already getting too many underqualified students into college, and the remediation at that level is very expensive. What does your research tell you about that challenge?
There are two things. It's certainly true that a substantial fraction of current individuals entering both four-year and community colleges take remedial courses, remediation courses, that is about a quarter of them in some estimates. So clearly we have a lack of kids who are prepared for college because their high school educations, even though they got high school degrees and actually seem to have done pretty well in high school. One of the big problems facing colleges is how poorly K through 12 schools are doing in many high schools. So that's true. On the other hand, it's also true that when we expand access to college, even with kids taking remediation classes at a more mature level when they are in high school, they actually seem to get a substantial economic benefit. And the way we know that is we have a number of natural, what I would call natural experiments out there, where we can essentially see two groups of individuals, one who had more access or cheaper access to similar colleges than others, and we can follow them later in life and see, does that greater access actually pay off in ways that look economically meaningful? And when certain states for certain cohorts reduce tuition or increase slots in colleges, even for kids taking some remediation classes, when you see those young adults 10 years later, they're actually earning more, they're doing much better on health and a number of different outcomes. You can even see this with very strong, what we'd call discontinuous differences. So some colleges and some scholarship programs have very clear rules. If your ACT is above 21, you get it. If it's below 21, you don't. If your SAT is, you know, above 1,050, you get this scholarship. So someone with 1,049 SAT and someone with 1,051 are pretty equivalent. But the one with 1,051 gets a much easier chance of going to college. Yet on all other aspects, they're pretty similar. When you follow these people out 5-10 years later, the person who did an extra year, 2-4 years of college is picking up 12-15% higher earnings a year for each year in college. So even if part of what college is doing is remediating and getting people up to speed, it pays off. So holding our weak high school system constant, greater access to college seems to pay off economically for individuals and societies. That's not saying that we wouldn't be better off if most kids entering college were much better prepared.
What are the lessons that we should learn about these first two great education transformations, the Common School Movement and the high school movement, that would help us complete this third transformation of mass participation in college education?
One important lesson we should learn is that one shouldn't stick with one's status quo view of how many people can actually get through different levels of schooling. Many people thought in the mass common school movement that it was ludicrous to think everyone could get a common school degree. Many people, particularly European observers, in the U.S. in the early 20th century, observed the U.S. creating high schools and thought this was a waste, that, you know, most people couldn't do high school work, when in fact we very rapidly got to 70% of people doing it with very high rates of return. Similarly, today we hear people, there's recent work, for example, by Charles Murray, who has written a recent book in which he argues that just too many people go to college and that only, you know, maybe 20% of people are qualified and can benefit from college education. When we give people opportunities and real resources, they seem to take advantage. When we do it in a decentralized way where colleges pay attention to the signals from employers about what works, when high schools do that, we seem to get a lot of innovative teaching and educational practices, and many more young people seem to benefit from education as technology evolves and as, you know, access improves than you would have thought from looking 20 years before, 10 years before in the present. So we know that in the past we've gone well beyond what people thought was possible by the criterion of educational attainment in their day. And the two facts that many countries are now ahead of us in college and high school completion, and then on the margin when we create access to that, we get very high returns, suggests that if we reignited our lessons, made it easier for better and more motivated teachers to teach in our high schools to try to turn that around, created a little more access to college, got kids better prepared for school, it could have a very high payoff. And it's both a payoff and growth, and it's a payoff in a more equitable society, because when we expand education rapidly, we hold in check the forces towards growing inequality that have been so visible in the U.S. over the last few decades.
We'll have more from our conversation with Lawrence Katz in a moment, but first, for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we go to Nate Berg of Planetizen.
When it comes to green ideas and progressive urban planning policies, New York City seems to be leading the nation. PlanYC, the city's 127-point blueprint for greening the city, is widely regarded as one of the country's most effective planning documents aiming at a sustainable future. But one area in which New York has so far failed to innovate is congestion pricing. Earlier this year, legislators blocked a bill that would have allowed the city to charge drivers as they entered certain parts of the city. But where New York failed, San Francisco is stepping in. The West Coast city is also clamoring to up its green cred, and a congestion charge could provide a major boost. City officials this week were presented with possible tolling locations and pricing schemes, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. The city received a $1 million grant from the federal government to study the feasibility of a system, and now there are options on the table. If approved, San Francisco's congestion pricing system would be the first in the nation. And just over a month ago, we were seeing reports that nearly one out of every six homeowners owed more on their homes than they were worth. Now, that figure has risen to one out of every four. 25% of the nation's homeowners have more to pay on their homes than they could possibly hope to gain by selling them, according to research by the real estate data firm First American CoreLogic. Florida and Arizona are feeling it the worst, with more than 29% of homes underwater. And things are almost as bad in California, with 27%, according to an article from McClatchy Newspapers. And things are expected to get even worse. Some analysts are predicting a further drop in home values by almost 10 to 15%. Such a drop could bring the amount of homes worth less than their mortgages up to almost 40%. And finally, it's been assumed for years that bad-looking neighborhoods encourage bad behavior. New evidence suggests that this assumption holds water. The Economist reports that researchers in the Netherlands have tested the so-called broken windows theory to reveal that delinquent activity actually does increase in areas that appear to be more disheveled. The experiments tested to see how people would act in different physical locations, one clean and tidy, and the other littered with trash and covered with graffiti. According to their report in Science magazine, the experiments showed that the existence of litter, graffiti, and other indicators of, quote, disorder increased the number of people who engaged in bad behavior, like littering and stealing. And while completely removing litter and graffiti from a neighborhood isn't likely to eliminate criminal behavior, studies like this will undoubtedly get the attention of law enforcement and city officials looking for more neighborhood cleanup funds. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after this short break, we'll have more from our conversation with author and economist Lawrence Katz, and we'll speak with Mitchell Joachim about redesigning cities from the ground up. You're listening to Smart City, and I'm Carol Coletta.
Hi, I'm Scotty Iseri, and if you're hearing my voice right now, it means you're listening to the podcast version of Smart City. And I have a message specifically for you, the podcast listener. We usually get a lot of really great comments via email from our listeners. They have questions about the show, things they heard. They have comments about things we got wrong or things we got right. Really intelligent input. And we thought, why don't we create a space online where our listeners can talk to each other? That's why we've created My City. My City is a social networking site for urban enthusiasts, people that love cities, people that want to see cities thrive, people that have ideas about making the next great city. So, how do you join? You send me an email, Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com. Send me an email, I'll send you an invite, join the conversation online. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Smart City, and I'm Carol Coletta. Let's get back to our conversation with Lawrence Katz. We've been talking about America's education system, what we do right, what we need to improve on. I asked him to advise President-elect Barack Obama on what he would recommend.
Over the long run, certainly better access to early childhood education is extremely important. When kids aren't ready to start learning when they enter, it makes it very difficult for the K through 12 system. We have a ton of evidence suggesting that providing, you know, high quality preschool, early childhood education, Head Start done well, has a very high payoff. And then that feeds into making K through 12 education easier and having more people ready for college, not having to do remedial work. For those who are ready for college, we need to create better financial aid access. That's going to pay off in the long run in terms of higher tax revenues from the higher earnings of people who go on. As we see, there's a very high rate of return on the margin for college-ready people getting access to college. Those things are very clear. What to do in the K through 12 system, I think, is a much more complicated and difficult question that I wish I knew the answers. Certainly, we know one thing that matters is the quality of teachers. Making it easier for talented and motivated young people without traditional teaching credentials to be able to teach in our major school systems would certainly be one step in the direction. And we've seen a lot of examples of experiments there that work. Making it easier to reward teachers who are doing a good job, who are raising the test scores, improving kids' lives also seems to be working. We have a lot of recent evidence on that part. And trying to make sure that, you know, there's a clear motivation and connection to learning for younger kids, particularly in inner city schools. They see, you know, more clearly the benefits. Trying to do many strategies, often using things that are like career academies and tech prep, where you take middle and high school students and try to connect, showing their learning actually relates to jobs out there, is valuable, not because of they're going to lead to traditional apprenticeship. You spend time having someone combining working as a health technician and doing high school work will lead them to be a health technician, because it's a real way of showing in context how the things you learn about biology might pay off in terms of further education in the labor market. So there's no one path, but there are a lot of things we could do to make our current resources, you know, I don't think it's just spend on K through 12. It's making our current resources more effective. And one of the key things we can do is experiment and then try to learn from experimenting.
When you talk about better access to early childhood education, is Head Start the model, or are there other models that you have been impressed with the results we've been getting?
I think Head Start is a model, but Head Start is very heterogeneous. That is, you know, there are thousands of Head Start centers in the U.S. If the model were the best performing Head Start centers, you know, that start at age two, try to get parents involved, have very motivated and, you know, individuals working as instructors and childcare people, that is a very good model. So if we got the upper half of the distribution of Head Start for our dollars, we would be doing a very good job. A very big question, if you were thinking about spending your, you know, say you had an extra $1 billion to spend on Head Start or $100 million, should you just create more slots? Or should you try to beef up the ones that aren't working too well? That's very much an open question. You'd probably want to do some of both. Head Start, as it operates in some places, really is strapped and improving the qualifications of some of the people working there, getting parents more involved, emphasizing health as well as education aspects of it can have a high payoff. And so if we could have a high-quality Head Start guaranteed to every child, it would have a very beneficial effect. But just throwing money in some of the poor operating areas would be a problem.
Yeah, and from your standpoint, what's the lowest hanging fruit here that would increase college attainment?
The lowest hanging fruit in the short run really is reducing the complexity of the college aid system and creating more access to college aid as tuition goes up to people who are already college ready. That by itself would not, you know, massively increase college education because there's so many people who aren't college ready. But the one key thing we see is today over 50% of all full-time college students work in the labor market to try to support themselves for college, basically 20 hours a week. In the short run, given what's happening in the economy and the labor market, one, that's a difficult thing to handle, both doing a full college load and working, but two, that source of income is going to be declining dramatically as the economy slows down. In the Great Depression, we actually expanded investment in education as kids went into high school, as jobs cleared out. Given college tuition today, if you don't have earnings from a job, that's going to be very difficult to do. So certainly in the short run, we need to create more college aid, either in loans or in grants, because they're really not going to be able to use jobs in the current labor market as a way of doing it. And in fact, when we shift the aid that way, we see big payoffs. Kids can study more and get more out of college. West Virginia has done a program known as the Promise Program, where they guarantee kids who do well in high school free tuition. And so the kids don't have to work as much when they're in college. And you see huge increases in the fraction of kids who actually finish college in 4 years when they take a full load and don't have to work 20 hours a week. Today, that's, you know, increasingly important since we're moving to the lowest employment rates we've ever seen for youth in the current widening recession.
One more question, and that is, who do you think knows the most about reducing the cost of college? The cost, not the price, but the cost.
There are a lot of different costs, you know, associated with college. It's not clear that just minimizing the cost is what we want to do. For example, we could have more students per instructor and reduce the cost, but we might not get as large a bang for the buck out of that. So it's having, you know, one thing we can do that is eventually going to reduce the cost is invest in taking better use of technology, which is working from a lot of important distance learning options. And second, a greater supply of highly educated workers and faculty members will reduce prices going there over the long run. But I don't think there's any simple solution to that. Much of those costs are actually paying for student services and other factors. You know, they're open questions whether all of them really are necessary. You know, do we need as many counselors and other factors? But if you actually look at the budgets of universities, a lot of it's in overhead and administrators. And I would certainly admit there a little more financial pressure on them to reduce the number of administrators that are non-research and non-teaching probably would go some way to keeping college more affordable.
Larry, great discussion. Thank you so much for sharing what you learned in writing your book, The Race Between Education and Technology. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
And I must note, and we should say, that all this work is joint with Claudia Golden, my co-author on it. She played, you know, the key role in all of this.
All right. Thanks so much, Larry.
Okay.
Lawrence Katz is a professor of economics at Harvard University and co-author of the book, The Race Between Education and Technology. For links to his work, come to smartcityradio.com. Mitchell Joachim is our next guest. He's on Wired Magazine's 2008 Smart List as one of the 15 people the next president should listen to. He's worked in the architecture firms of Frank Gehry and the Michael Sorkin Studios and now runs his own not-for-profit organization, Terraform One. It is a philanthropic design collaborative that seeks to integrate ecological principles into the urban environment. Mitch, if we were to look at a map of cities of the future, what are the trends and challenges that would have driven the changes that we would then see in those cities?
Let's see. If we're looking at a map, well, there's a number of issues. One is infrastructure, another is energy, and another is environment, and probably many, many more issues of housing, open space are all certainly relevant. But the future city itself is something that needs this kind of a roadmap. We need a line of desire to project what the next 100 years will bring. So we certainly don't necessarily have that in all places. And I think that people aren't used to viewing them. But having a master plan or some proposal of the world, or a city specifically, as it might be, I think that's important that architects, urban designers, city planners think about these lines of desires that come from community groups, come from people, come from citizens, to think about or project what the future city might be. And I think that major goals, there are many. The chief one that we're concerned with is ecology and how it relates to human dwelling and human mobility. The future reification of the city's got to take this into account rather profoundly.
And when you say profoundly, tell me what you really mean and what the scope of that would look like.
Exactly that. We're about visioning. We produce images, drawings, plans, sections, architectural solutions that give weight and measure and some physicality to the design of this kind of a city, a city predicated on ecological principles, mixing and integrating the environment with who we are and how we dwell.
there's some feeling that we have simply no time to waste. And yet when you talk in terms of cities and a 100-150-year time frame, it sort of takes all the urgency away from it, doesn't it? I mean, I won't be here in 100 years. Our company may not be here in 100 years. You know, the market may not develop. So there's this sense of we can wait to get started. And yet, obviously, if we continue to wait, we'll never get through that 100 years. So how do you create something through imagination that then draws people to it, or do you have to at the same time be creating that urgency through imagination?
I think the urgency, you're right, is out there. There are many that claim that we've got about 50 years to solve this environmental problem before it won't be solvable anymore. I'm sure that would all change if gas becomes $10 a gallon at the pump. Then we could immediately go to these, quote, imaginary ideas and make them happen very, very soon, or at least look through the constitution of those ideas and find the ones that are most applicable and get to it right away. So I think there are certain drivers that lead to a cause and an effect. You can look backwards and see many examples of cities imagining future cities. You know, 100 years ago, for instance, there is King's Dream of New York. In 1908, they were depicting the future of the city in a certain fashion, that we'd be moving around in dirigibles and connecting to skyscraper docks and bridged systems would link elevator core to elevator core, and this fantastic arcaded pathways for pedestrians and all sorts of mobility systems from horses to slow-moving traffic to fast-moving traffic, etc., and bridging the hell out of everything. You know, not much of that is actually occurred, but the vision's been around, and it's been a great point of departure to argue, to serve as a central polemic about what we should do with infrastructure in cities, but this one specific to New York. And it's these kinds of platforms that are necessary to produce real applications, to produce a real policy, to produce real technologies that work these conditions out. So drawing it and imagining it is certainly a part of it, but then the arguing and the critical discourse behind it amps it up further.
You mentioned $10 a gallon gasoline as one clear driver. Things begin to change if gas goes to $10, and it's clear that's true. Are there other such developments that would create a real sense of momentum and urgency that you can think of?
There are emergencies everywhere, and scientists are, you know, thinkers are pointing them out as much as we can. Al Gore, for example, will point out the polar bears are drowning, the poles are melting. Here are images of polar bears drowning. It doesn't, you know, whether this resonates with the average American, let's say Homer Simpson, will he care? Is it in his value systems to create massive change or devote his hard-earned cash into changing whatever he can in society because polar bears are drowning? I don't know. I think it's our job as designers, architects, planners, to have these provisions in hand already, to design these objects, cities, etc., to fit within the environment. I think that our professions have already joined on in this understanding that there is change that needs to happen quickly. We do feel a sense of urgency and immediacy. You know, the more of these visions of, you know, polar bears drowning, the more convinced the rest of America will be that, hey, you know, maybe I should invest an extra couple of bucks and get bamboo flooring instead of, you know, some carcinogenic vinyl stuff.
You've mentioned objects. Let's talk about a couple of them that you've delved into pretty seriously. One is the stackable car.
Yeah, the stackable car is a smart car for today's city that eventually needs to replace these cumbersome ways of moving around that we do today. The stackable car is essentially a vehicle that interlocks and connects to many other vehicles, and it's a social vehicle. It's a networked vehicle. It's talking to one another. In fact, the entire vehicle is in the wheel itself. So it's essentially these robotic wheels that are linked and networked, talking to other robotic wheels in a whole field of distributed talking wheels. These wheels are talking about potholes in the road. They're talking about the vehicles in front of them. They're talking about spaces their driver or the passenger likes to go to. And they're constantly communicating. Where the cars stack is where they need to park. So eventually these wheels at some point stop moving about the city and need to find some location for storage. So the frame that these wheels are supported on can articulate and stand up, and the car behind it can also park inside this frame like shopping carts. Mm-hmm. And you can park about 800 of these things on a New York City block as opposed to 34 SUVs.
Wow. Okay, so if you, you know, this investment, shall we say, in the car companies, American car companies, seems to be on the horizon. Surely someone from GM or Ford or Chrysler has paid attention to your notion of a stackable car. It certainly had a lot of publicity. Have you ever gotten a call?
Oh, well, General Motors was one of the major sponsors of that vehicle. It was worked on at the MIT Media Lab. I think ultimately General Motors realized that we were proposing something that is not for them as far as their core business model. And that was our job. Our job was to think way out of the box, to say things that you'd be fired if you were an engineer working for General Motors. We were to be as critical as possible of not their company, but the vehicles they were designing. In fact, any mobility systems that work in cities or mobility systems, period. And it wasn't just about designing one car, but many, many iterations of vehicles that solve big problems. And the stackable car was one example. It's an American car company, but it was a shared ownership model.
Well, I understand that. But so who takes up that idea commercially?
Well, General Motors is not interested in public transportation. They're not interested in necessarily shared ownership vehicles. They're interested in selling a single car to a single person or groups of cars to a single company. But they don't. It's not their business model to make vehicles that are semi-public. The cars that we had looked at and many of the vehicles we designed, we realized that cars for cities can't be owned by individuals.
Exactly. So are we talking a Zipcar type company that would understand this?
Exactly. Zipcar is a great paradigm. It's similar to the Zipcar, except for Zipcar uses pre-made vehicles. Instead, we're using one of the business models Zipcar deploys and building a technology to make it more convenient for the city.
You've also considered the prospect of growing buildings on site. How do you do that? And what would that mean for jobs associated with construction?
Another task we had at MIT was there was a report, you know, it was an energy report, looking at what MIT can do for the next, you know, 50 years to change our American economy to be more efficient when it came to energy use. This report was divided up to various disciplines, physics, mathematics, you know, whoever, various types of engineering. The architecture department was asked to create a 300% increase in building systems. 300%. It's actually a tall order. So we provided a solution that was also going to try and fit that need. And we thought of an ancient gardening technology called pleating, which is essentially grafting inosculate matter together or grafting trees together to make structures. It's nothing new. It's been around for 2,500 years. We thought that if we look at the life cycle on how we build today, how we make buildings, and we want to vastly decrease the amount of energy consumption, we've got to rethink where we get our materials, how we assemble our materials, and ultimately what we do with them at the end. So we thought that if the structures themselves are not virgin materials, in other words, a bunch of tough guys going into the forest, ripping down some trees with a hell of a lot of energy and putting them on trucks that take a lot of energy to bring them to a sawmill to reduce them to building components using yet even more energy, then driven to a site and assembled into a house, and then the house lasts for 50 to 100 years before it ends up in a landfill, we needed to rethink this life cycle. So we thought that we can have species of trees, you know, local ecology, find the species of trees that are graftable and build a jig, a reusable scaffold that would control the geometry of these trees into a specific shape and find species that grow rather quickly to get, you know, a whole space or a space about 9 feet in height within 5 to 7 years. And make this these homes fully fit into the metabolism of its environment. They are not taken from someplace else and reduced to components, but instead are already existing and are just simply shaped, a piece of nature as it is, as it's working, shaped into something usable for people.
I love the idea, and it's obviously out there. So if you took that idea that was a, you know, that was a thought experiment at MIT, and you said, what about that is practical that would inform what we do today or tomorrow? What would that be?
We knew that the 100% living home was a tall order, and we decided that we'd look at a 50% version where only the walls would be living. Only certain parts of the house would be living, would be basically a web of ficus or some kind of local species of trees. And the rest would be business as usual timber frame construction. This was necessary to do because of a lot of fighting we had with zoning boards. I couldn't guarantee that the house would stop growing at 38 feet in a particular area. A big issue that we ran into. Also with insurance. And getting bondable contractors to assemble it. Our contractors are mostly carpenters that work with power tools, not botanists. Insurance companies had problems with us guaranteeing that the roof wouldn't leak in 40 years. You know, that we would, in this case, we would require more study about capillary activity of water in a living treehouse. We do harvest the rainwater for a gravity-fed plumbing system, but guaranteeing that the roof would leak is something that we couldn't do. So we had an alternative to escape a lot of these planning and zoning issues. And this project was called Matscape, which was a 50% living wall solution and 50% business-as-usual timber construction to meet those scales of economy and to fit within our current systems of policies and assembling housing in America.
What advice would you give to a mayor who asks you, how do I future-proof my city?
Well, one of the first things we can do right away to mitigate issues in the environment is to reduce our population growth. I think we have to stop having more people. People are essentially the problem, and especially an abundance of people with this Malthusian growth rate. Too many folks are creating massive issues when it comes to use of water, energy, life supplies. The human race is logarithmically increasing per decade, more or less. So there seems to be this constant growth of people and the amount of people that are taking up the earth. So, you know, essentially that there's a lot of models on how we think about changing our relationship to the environment. We think about efficiency models, we think about zero models, and we think about positive contributor models. And I think the last one is the one we have to strive for. Positive contributions to the metabolism of the environment, positive contributions to an ecology. Because if you think of the alternatives, which is the efficiency model, you're still doing a lot of bad. Efficiency means my car still runs on fossil fuels, but I use less of them. It's a more efficient vehicle. But I'm still doing a lot of bad because I'm using fossil fuels. The zero model, or the neutral model, that people often say should be a principle that we should achieve or should go for to achieve a true sustainable environments, the problem with that is it's just incredibly nothing. It's just absolutely neutral. It's like Switzerland. It does no good. It does no bad. It's not efficient, but it's not inefficient. It's just there, like zero emission carpeting. It's just there. It has no effect on the environment whatsoever. So the conclusion that we've come to is that you must make positive contributions to the environment. Things like cars that are fuel cells that are accountable for 100 years of industrial pollution, that scrub the air as they move along. The air that they intake becomes cleaner when it's reproduced on the outside or given off. So this is the kind of technology you can find anywhere, but I think it's as a design directive for architects, planners, urban designers, this is the approach that we've got to take. We've got to make things that are positive contributors, that clean or become fitted into the constitution of the environment, not something that does nothing as the zero model or something that's just efficient.
Mitchell Joachim, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure, my pleasure.
Mitchell Joachim teaches at Columbia University and is the founder of the design collective Terraform One. You can find out more about Mitchell's work on reimagining cities at our website, smartcityradio.com. Even though the election season is over, well, almost, Walker Smith still senses some tensions in the air. This week, our City Views commentator brings us the story of finding his own path on the political trail and how a little understanding goes a long way.
Every Sunday, for a few years when I was a teenager in the late 1960s and early 1970s, I used to go to the post office with my friend Paul to hold a sign protesting the Vietnam War. I confess that I didn't understand the issues very well. Most of what I knew about Vietnam came from a book by Howard Zinn called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. It was only years later that I learned about Zinn's socialist politics and philosophy. But I had been persuaded by my friend Paul to go. His family belonged to the Religious Society of Friends, also known as Quakers. They are well known for their ardent pacifism. Hence, they oppose any war. That message resonated with me during those turbulent years of cultural and political strife in our country. My parents were not keen on what I was doing, but my parents always encouraged me to think through issues on my own, so they always let me follow my own logic, even if it took me into dead ends they knew in advance would go nowhere. This is not to say they weren't worried about me, though. Indeed, my mother would get into her station wagon after I had set out on my bike and circle the block around the post office a few times during the hour we would stand there from 11 to noon. She wanted to make sure I wasn't consorting with any drug-addled hippies, and she was worried that not everyone in our burgeoning southern town would be content to let us stand there in peace. There were indeed a few unpleasant encounters, mostly people screaming in our faces, but because I was just a teenager, and a pretty young teenager at that, most of the anger expressed by passers-by was directed at the adults. We felt relatively safe, though. We were in a very public place, and we stood on the lawn of the post office because it was federal property where we knew we were allowed to stand there without any kind of permit. What I remember most about that time now is how little I knew about the issues. Now, I haven't become a hawk, but I do have a better understanding of the nuances and complications of these kinds of issues. In particular, I have come to see that radical extremes are almost always blind to a number of important, valid considerations. I wouldn't say that I was a radical peacenik standing there in front of the post office, but I was certainly not open to competing perspectives, and I spent many hours in college lost in the maze of a closed worldview. Regrettably, the tendency nowadays is to demonize those with contrary opinions. We reduce them to a stereotype and consign them to a pigeonhole that strips them of any humanity or innate complexity. Having myself come from one place to another, I have been close to many people of differing opinions, and none of them are demons. Pretty much, they are all people who want the same things in life. They just want to get there in different ways. And like my parents, I think we must trust that letting people find their own paths, even the dead ends, will get us all to the right place in the end. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich, and he joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. There's a lot more Smart City waiting for you online at our website, smartcityradio.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter, download archive shows, and subscribe to our podcast. You can also find there links to our guest work and a way to get in touch and let us know how we're doing. As usual, you can email us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our turkey-filled producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.